And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started.
Some kind of way out of here. Say the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion. I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine. Plowman, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody
welcome back, Patty Quatro. I have to say, I don't know about you, but I keep thinking about your story. Being in the dressing room in late 1967 with Gladys Knight, the Pips were in the male dressing room, when she got news that Heard It Through the Grapevine, her version, had gone to number one. And that there she was, she burst into tears. And I don't know, I will never hear her version of that song again without thinking about you and the Pleasure Seekers and Gladys Knight and this magical moment backstage. What do you think about that? Is it just so normal for you?
It was so unrehearsed and spontaneous. I mean, we just hugged each other and she was such a sweet lady. She had a really cool vibe about her, but she was so affected affected, heartfelt affected that her song was now number one. It was just a very cool moment. I'll never forget it either.
Well, I'm actually glad to hear that because, oh, it's just so special. So, as I said, this was the end of 1967, and we're now entering 1968, and you don't stop playing. It's just because it's a new year, I mean, you are on the road, on the road, on the road. You're off and running. And I do want to give a brief recap of the new band lineup we talked about. So, it's you, Arlene, and Susie Quattro. You have Dar Arnone, or Dar Thumper, and now you have Pammy and the Bird. And because I'm such an animal lover and because I do not play guitar, I misspelled bird. I spelled it BIRD. And that's not the case at all. You know, I'm thinking, oh, I could have been Kristen and the kitten or something.
The
But
song.
no, of course, bird meant her instrument, if you will. And so, Patty, before we talk about anything else, will you please set the record straight for Pam Bamford and the Bird?
Should I flip you the bird? It was a Birdland, Gibson Birdland guitar. And it was a favorite from a lot of people. And she was just crazy over her guitar. So it's BYRD, Birdland guitar.
I love that, and yes, I would deserve to be flipped the bird in this one. Really, I was just blinded by my animal stuff. So anyway, Pammy and the Bird. Okay, so when I say now, really, that you guys are off and running, I mean you were held over at Trudy Heller's clubs. I mean, in so many other venues in the area, out of state, but close to New York, and weeks turned into months, and all of this is happening so fast. You're getting time and attention like you never have before. And I just want you to talk about how this is all unfolding.
It was a very busy time because there was, signing with ABC and Leo was working hard on getting us a record deal. Everything came to the fore, like, okay, what next? What next? What next? And we just kept playing and playing with our foot on the gas. We were seriously now involved because of this new lineup. We had fine musicians, great attitude. We had the same motivations. So it was a good place.
It was a good place to be in, and also you now had serious support. You were signed by ABC Booking with Joe Glazer, and he took you on personally and believed in you. Trudy Heller now was taking all of you under her wings and getting you out there. And Leo Fenn, as you said, your manager, is now not just helping with booking gigs. He is putting together demo and press kits for record labels to shop the pleasure seekers for a record deal. And so for those who may not know what a demo or a press kit entails, and we're talking now, what, late 1967, but really early 1968. Tell us what that kind of kit would entail. Describe what Leo would be putting together.
Well, it's hilarious. I do remember, and I think I have one in my my cupboards somewhere. It was a pink, hot pink folder, right? And it had two flaps on the inside. So he would have put pictures and he would have put a resume, whatever he had, he would have put in that folder to send to different record companies. And that was basically it. He might have included the What a Way to Die album if he had copies of that, but he did it all himself. That was his thing.
First of all, please find that hot pink folder in your drawers. I have to see that,
Yeah,
please.
I have to
Let's see
find, I know I have one.
it. But also, what you're talking about, just to be really clear here, is the singles from The Hideout of What a Way to Die and
Yeah.
Never Thought You'd Leave Me. And a
Right.
demo is often in the biz, it was a demonstration, short for a demo, of what could be heard or seen by a band. The cool thing about your press and demo kit is that these were legit singles already.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
These were not little house tapes that you did with a little dinky microphone. This was serious.
And it wasn't just Detroit. I mean, that was a regional hit in a whole bunch of areas around Michigan, and we knew that. So it would have been something that Leo would have wanted to include, of course.
And did this press kit include new photography with Pammy, who replaced Eileen Bidlingmeyer?
I think we were so damn busy, and maybe one of the girls can correct me, but I don't think we took new pictures until we got to the Northwest. with the blue and white lace, which we'll be showing. But I think we were stuck with those because we were so busy and so on the road. So no, I don't think we had new pictures at that particular point.
Well, and to add to that, it's not that you weren't a hot band and people weren't interested, but it was a different price tag back then to hire a photographer and take pictures and have it developed. And then if it was 8x10, you'd have to get multiple copies. So it wouldn't have been like taking a snapshot off your iPhone and then uploading it. And so Leo shops the band with your press kits. And again, we're talking like in January. At this
Yes.
all, beginning of 68, and Mercury Records bites really fast. And I want you to tell us about what happens next, Patty.
Well, it was really shocking that that gig, that press came out from Richie York. He was a prominent Toronto writer at that time. I remember Richie. And he mentions we just signed in his last paragraph, and his press thing was in January. That's damn quick. I mean, that means Mercury hit real fast. Either he got it wrong or they were in the process of signing us, but that's what he wrote. So,
Well, and let me underscore that, Patty. That's a contemporary writer. So
yes.
obviously he was getting information that there was either going to be or there was a signing in early January. So I'm sorry, go on.
Exactly. And, it just re-emphasizes my point, cut and paste. A lot of times things, even in press, are taken from someone else and they're regurgitated, in its form, and it could be wrong, it could be right. But Richie was pretty on top of his game in the press. So I have to think that he knew something, and printed it correctly. So I know they bit quick. They really did. They came right back to us.
Well, and Patty, just on an aside, you have often shared with me privately that Canada, because you were so close geographically, that Canada was a really intense music scene. They had an intense music scene up there, including music journalists. So I don't want to presume anything because we would have to back it up with other evidence, but I imagine that this what was his name? Richie York, who was a
Richie York.
prominent Toronto writer at
Oh,
that
yeah.
time, would have absolutely been at the top of his game to know of which he wrote, if you will.
Yes. And Yonge Street in Toronto. Oh, my God. Toronto. We loved playing Toronto. They had so many great clubs. Oh, and we'll get into those. But yeah, we did a lot of touring in Canada that's coming up. I mean, we're really expanding outward, not only nationally, but also into Canada. So, a lot of tours in Canada.
A lot of tours, and also now, as you said, a lot of press to pull from and to call from. So, as we were saying, Mercury Records bites fast. This is January 68. I would like you to tell us who Dick Corby was from Mercury Records.
Dick Corby was a Mercury Records in-house producer. He came to hear us at Trudy's while we were doing that gig, and he checked us out. He came more than one night. I mean, we have pictures that I've given you, and a handsome, tall guy, and on his game at Mercury, and they sent him to check us out. And, he was filling in the suits back at the ranch, that, hey, they're really something and saying good things. And they believed him, they trust his opinion, and he showed up a lot, and that was it. They bit. They wanted to sign us right away.
So just to clarify for myself, Dick Corby was in a way now the new version of Joe Glazier from ABC. Dick Corby had to see you first as an in-house producer to
Yes.
then say to Mercury Records, yes, you need to sign this band.
Yes. Yes, he had to give his okay because he was going to be probably the producer. Otherwise, they wouldn't have sent him, So, made sense.
Really interesting. Now, we had talked about how both Susie and Darlene at this point in the Pleasure Seekers time are still underage. Now, they had both officially dropped out of high school, but that doesn't mean they're still, they can't necessarily go to a bar and drink. And so I'm wondering, as you're now performing for Mercury Records and this deal is about to happen, did you have to, like with ABC and Joe Glazier, get any kind of parental approval, or did the parents just say, do whatever? What was happening? They were at home. They weren't touring with you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I didn't write that in my diary whether we had to get approval signing with ABC, but we must have, you know, and it was just done quickly. And it is in my diary that we had to get approval from Mercury, from our parents. So Leo had to call them, the company had to talk to the parents, and they were all on board, of course. Lily Weaver was like, "Hell yeah," you know, and my dad, they were fine. They were just fine.
I actually would have been shocked at this point with the new band lineup and all of that, if anybody would say, "No, you know what? You've come this close. Let's stop now." So, oh, that's amazing. I mean, I keep saying this, but it really is a fairy tale. It's magical. And again, we're only in the first month of 1968,
Oh,
and
yeah.
getting this notoriety in the press. And
Oh.
I want to talk a little bit now because yes, it's the journalists and the press and all that, but your fan base now is really starting to widen. And this
Yes.
includes, we did talk many episodes ago about some of your male groupies who later, when you were in Fanny, would call your male groupies.
Yes.
But we're talking the pleasure seekers here. But you have a really funny story, and I want to tease it out a little bit after you talk about it, but it just really made me think about, female groupies get a lot of attention, but male groupies not so much. So let me say the Pleasure Seekers are booked. It's January 8th through January 22nd, 1968. You're at the Friars Club in Toronto, Ontario. And tell us about what antics happen next.
We were at the gig, and some guy, actually, we were at the hotel, and some guy tried to push into our hotel room. And Leo must have seen it somehow, or, you know, heard us saying, "Hey," you know, or yelling. And he had to stop the guy and push him away. He was getting very pushy at the door. Just thought he could just walk in, you know. And it's no wonder we needed a male manager on the road. But he put an end to it, and it became a continuing issue, you know, way more than gropies. You know, this was
These are
more dangerous, and there are some dramatic stories coming in the future when Leo was not with us. And, you know, we suffered this. It happened more than once.
Wow.
Crazy.
We will definitely continue this theme because I do think it's important, and I don't think because of the gender difference within rock and roll, it is interesting to think about how a male groupie would handle an all-female band as a fan. Differently.
You know, and the more harmless gropies in time actually became grabbingly aggressive as we kept gaining notoriety. This is what happened.
That's so fascinating. Well, I can't wait to hear more stories about this because I have thoughts on this because you also, as we said, you experienced this in Fanny, and that was 1974. And you're
Yes.
now in 68 with the Pleasure Seeker. So this will continue and it's ongoing. Okay, so putting the panties capers aside for a second, as I just want to continue again these dates that you're playing because now this is weeks turning into months, as we said. So by February 1st of 68, you did a week winter weekend concert, an animal show. And no, as I asked you privately, there were not live animals there, keeping my love of animals alive. It was a theme for a party, as you told me.
Right,
This
yeah.
was Ottawa, Ontario, a University of Ottawa. And again, we said Canada is just welcoming you with open arms because
Oh,
you
yeah.
are now not just nationally prominent, you're becoming internationally prominent. And you talked a little bit about Canada before, but talk to us about this animal show or anything you remember from these gigs.
Well, it was a university thing, so it was younger crowd and stuff, and they were having like 5 different days of things at different venues, and we went over great. Canada was so receptive always. And we had a blast. It was a fun gig.
That's
Another,
great.
yeah,
That's
another gig.
great. So after Ottawa, you come back. It's February 7th through 11th, and you're at Grandmother's. And we have some wonderful graphic art that we have shown and will show again. Grandmother's was a club, and it was in East Lansing, Michigan. And I'm curious about this graphic art, Patty. I mean, when it was created for you back then, did you love it? Who designed it? The one of Arlene is so cool. I'm just curious about anything you remember.
Of course, they picked up on Arlene. I mean, a lot of times she was, my God, on the old MySpace, guys used to put her picture up as their profile picture. So our link got always got a lot of attention, and there's more coming up. But yeah, those cartoon things, I don't know who did them. I would guess that somebody at the, within the hierarchy of that club did the cartoons. We didn't do any of them. Leo didn't do them. Somebody did them, and they were really clever. They kept putting up a different one each day that we were there. It was great.
Did you save any of those? Did you keep them?
I don't think so. Just on my archives, yes. I don't. Well, you know what? I must have the ads in my cupboards.
Oh, I would
Got them
love.
to the computer, so they must be in there, in the millions of boxes I have.
The physical copies I would love to see. I just think that would be
Yeah.
so cool. So, okay, now it's February and you are now going back to Trudy Heller's, but this time not New York. You're going to her West Palm Beach, Florida club, which I didn't even know she had one there. I mean, you're just going up and down the coast now. This is incredible. And then going to Canada, up and down.
North to south, I mean, God, were we driving around?
And you just said something before you tell us about Trudy Heller's gig in West Palm Beach. Obviously, you were driving. I shouldn't say obviously. You were not flying, correct? This is
Nope.
all on the road.
On the road again. We lived on the road.
Clearly. And Susie lived in the U-Haul on the road. So tell us about West Palm Beach, Florida, and Trudy Heller's there.
It was very she-she the way she decided to do it. It's funny, so different than the New York, the trick and all that. That was all rock and roll, hippie, nightclubbish. This was like upscale. It was pink and green and white, and we even had this little scrolly fence around the stage, and it catered to all the rich people there. And I'm sure stars were coming in. I don't remember who, but we were just playing the gig, and during one. Oh my God. One night, we're doing our set, and my stupid foot got caught in the tambourine. And there I am, like an idiot, trying to just, I tried to shake it off quick, and it would not come out. So I'm having to, like, I'm moving and grooving, and I'm like going side to side, different height. It just looks so dumb. I look like an idiot. And I just kept it up. Of course, my girls were just laughing their butt off, as they saw me trying to keep my cool.
Well, first of all, did the audience notice? I'm just curious.
I don't know if somebody up front noticed. I tried to hide it by the way I was moving, but it didn't work. I was going up and down, up and down. I don't know what they were thinking. It was funny.
Oh, that's hilarious. Well, you were saying your other bandmates were teasing you, and I know we've spoken a little bit about this, but I want to hear more that you were kind of known for being teased because you were Gestapo Pat. And so your other bandmates did tease you often, including having your foot in the tambourine. You couldn't shake
Oh my
it off.
God.
But I'm curious if you want to just share with us a couple of these stories of being teased with love, of course, on this road trip or these endless road trips.
I think they took it out on me lovingly because I was such a Gestapo, cracking the whip all the time. I was the one that had to do it, keep them in line. I mean, they were fun-loving girls, and they loved to have a go at me anytime they could. I'd be in a snit in the elevator, something that had gone wrong on a song or something, and I was always saying something, to improve us. And they would push an elevator button, a wrong floor. And I would go tearing out, mad, the first one out the door, and they would close the door, laughing their butts off that there I was on some floor I wasn't supposed to be on. They did that all the time. I mean, all kinds of stuff like that happened. It never stopped.
Maybe you can laugh at it now. Did you
Oh,
laugh
yeah.
at it? Did you laugh at it then, or did you feel hurt?
Sometimes. It just depended on what was happening. I remember one time Susie and Arlene held up an entire plane saying goodbye to their boyfriends. And there I was, oh my God, we're going to miss our flight. It was to Hawaii. And I was furious beyond belief. And they come waltzing up like nothing was wrong. Those two were always getting in trouble. And, they just thought it was hilarious. And the plane waited for us. Don't ask me why. But we got on and we made our next stop. But oh, I was ready to kill him.
Well, first of all, at this point, we're going to get to Arlene when she breaks up with Leo Fenn
Yeah.
because At this point, she is still married to Leo
She's
Fett.
still married. Oh,
So, but that's, I can't wait to hear more of these stories. And I'm just saying this because they would have hurt my feelings too. I would might be able to laugh at them later, but that's why I was asking. So it was hit or miss for you, I'm guessing. So after West Palm Beach and the tambourine incident, you're now heading back up the coast again, and you stop in South Carolina in February of 1968, and the pleasure seekers have another panty raids, another panty capers moment. And this is intense. Not that the other one wasn't, but I mean, as you said, it keeps escalating. So tell us about this.
It was the name of a place, and I'm not sure if it was the name of the cabins or the area, but it was called the Isle of Palms. And it was a gig, and we stayed at these cabins. And again, the panty raid, and our panties were stolen. And I don't know if somebody in another cabin was observing it or what, because we were not in the rooms when this robbery happened, but somehow the owner got caught out and he was arrested for it. Guess he had a fetish for our panties or wanted a souvenir. I don't know, it's in the rock either. But today, it might have been a marketing merch. Pleasure Seekers panties.
Oh,
Jeez.
I love it. I have to say, as the PR and marketer for us on a lot of our podcasts, oh, I would just run with that one. PR, panties, pleasure seekers, such great alliteration.
And he did. He ran, but he got caught.
Yes. No, he ran, but not in a good way. Oh, wow. Well, as I said, it's really interesting to think about the dynamics between how female groupies were back in this moment in time versus what let's say guys were, how they were treating you. And I do think it speaks to, it was at this point you were still an anomaly, whereas male bands in rock and roll were a little bit more ubiquitous now. So I do think it was a little bit more shocking. So it's definitely a topic of male groupies that I think we should, I don't know, somebody needs to write on this. I mean, we can lovingly recall, and I think it was episode 7, Horny Teens in a Sweatbox. We had our beloved compact queen who was
I don't
keeping
know what.
her souvenirs in a compacts, but now you have these guys who are stealing your panties.
I don't know why they did it to us. I mean, the band was good looking, I have to say. It never happened in Fanny. I don't remember any of this. Maybe time had marched on and it was a different era, but we were so new and, in this aura of girl band coming out. I don't know, maybe they just glommed onto it from gropies to stealing stuff. I mean, it was crazy.
Or maybe the gals in Fanny, and I don't mean to speak for you, weren't wearing any panties. So maybe there was that.
I don't know.
It was a
Oh
very
my
different
God.
time in 74, but yes.
Yes, it was. It
Well,
was.
one of the things that I also think is fascinating to think about, because we've been talking about your dad and your brother and the Quattros around the pleasure seekers and the support that all of you were getting, even Darlene and now Pam, right? So you're, but this is 1968, and this is in February, I believe, still. I mean, this is all so new. And as the pleasure seekers are touring for weeks and months out of state, out of Detroit, your brother, Michael Quattro, who at this point is a renowned PR guy with his own booking agency in Detroit, and he books a gig with no other than Jimi Hendrix. This is 1968 in the Masonic Temple Lodge. And so, Patty, I want you to tell us how this even came about. Tell us about your dad, Art Quattro, the limo service. This is just an amazing story, and it's multiple amazing stories.
It is hilarious. Mickey was exploding, okay, in that whole middle part of the United States as the PR guy, the promo guy. He was doing festivals. He was booking. He booked the Stones in. He booked Jimmy in. And he was the first to bring these international stars in. And then he continued on with the festivals. So Mickey had his big limo, okay, that he would use to take the rock stars from the airport and all that. And my dad, he had to get his nose in there. He often helped out being like the limo driver, if Mickey was busy at the venue. So there was my dad. And my dad picked up Jimmy, and Jimmy was in all his regalia, very colorful. And he started smoking a big reefer in the back seat. And my dad was, I'm sure he was making faces in the front seat. He could, what's going on? But he's driving him. And dad came home that day with a contact high. He was stoned from the reefer. We cracked up. And, I
Boy,
mean, we weren't
before.
there. We heard about it from Mickey. He told us. And then
Wait, before you go on, Patty, only because we've talked about the car industry and we've talked about pillars in Detroit as well and how all these guys didn't want to go in the car industry. Your father had to. But now your brother, just to clarify, he purchased a limo. So that he too would, he, so this is in a weird way now. He's kind of thumbing his nose at the car industry. Now he has a limo and he's picking up these rock stars and he never had to go into the car industry. So I just want to clarify that this was not like he was renting it.
And he had to cut a hole in his living room and make a box because the car wouldn't fit in his garage on Kerchival. So he made a box and disguised it with the TV and all that. And if you went in the garage, there's this empty, his car is going into the house. That was the only way he could figure out how to fit it in his garage. Mickey was a character. What can I tell you? He was
Well,
going to find a way.
on an aside, I actually have seen that house with your brother. He took me by there over the holidays. And it is so, it made me laugh because it would not be subtle having this huge piece of coming out of the house. I mean, it's right there on Kerchival. It's right there. And when your brother sold the house, part of the deal for the new owners was that they would fix the hole where the limo was.
Oh God, I'm not surprised. Yeah. Oh, that's
So
so
go
funny.
on, tell us more Jimmy stories.
Okay, so Jimmy, Mickey and Jimmy were in the car, the limo, driving to the gig now. Okay, and there's Jimmy. Mickey couldn't figure this one out. They're driving and talking, and Jimmy is out the window with his head sticking out the window, taking pictures of the snow. Mickey's like, what the fuck? He didn't know what the hell was going on, but he's taking pictures of the snow. And they come upon this guy. They had to miss the exit because it was closed. It was in Pontiac or Flint. And so they had to go one exit further and get off and backtrack. And they didn't know where they were going. There was no GPS thing. It was some venue that they have in every city. I am something, IMV, IMA, something. And so they asked some dude on the street as they were backtracking, do you know where the IM whatever, venue is? And the guy was like on the street with this crazy clothing, just some street person. And the guy looks at him, to Jimmy, and he says, yeah, and I'm the general. I'm the general. And they, oh God, how are we going to get to this gig? They didn't know where to go. The guy finally told them as they tried to explain. And they get to the gig, and Jimmy jumps out of the car, walks straight onto the stage. My dad was running the show until they got there, and they were late. Oh,
Oh,
well.
that's incredible. First of all, I wonder if those snow pictures have survived. He was probably high as a kite, and that was probably really trippy to him. But also, imagine that person who was saying, I'm a general. He had no idea that he was talking to somebody, a Jimi Hendrix.
No
Someday go, I mean, that is just legendary. And I can see your brother and Jimmy in his limo. That's just incredible, Patty. Oh, I'm so glad you talked to your brother about this because, again, you weren't there. You were touring all over. And I just want to, as we say goodbye on this particular episode, I just keep saying it because I can't believe it. This is January and February of 1968. And now you're touring all over the East Coast. Your Mercury Records is about to sign you. You're going to start recording soon. And I know it's one thing to reflect back, but Patty, can you transport yourself back in time as teenager Pat, serious Pat, and everything you had dreamed about with your epiphany only a few years earlier? And now, my dear, it's real. It's real. It's really happening. I want to hear what you were thinking.
I was always Serious Pat and Laughingly Gestapo, but I still had my vision in my mind of being a credible and strong band leader, and I was so content with this new lineup. It was exciting as hell. I felt it was very special and could make huge leaps now with the new escalated musicianship. that we had. We had a national booking agent. We were signing a label. Indeed, we were on a roller coaster to national noticed. I mean, that was the point. It felt amazing. So it had at that moment more gravitas with all that was happening and us gigging all over and pieces were falling into place. I felt like the Sinatra song, fly me to the moon and let me play among the stars. I mean, it was an incredible time.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand. In other words, baby, kiss me. Fill my heart with song and let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words, I love you. Song, let me sing for